Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Abusers in Hollywood are as old as the Hollywood sign itself. And while fame is the ultimate prize in Tinseltown, underneath it lies a shroud of mystery. Binge this season of Variety Confidential from Variety, Hollywood's number one entertainment news source and iHeart podcasts. 6 episodes are waiting for you right now to dive into the secret history of the casting couch, to explore the scandalous history of Hollywood's casting process. Listen to Variety Confidential on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200%ers. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like $1 million.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Holly Fry.
And I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And we are continuing our history of dentistry and oral health today. And we are basically picking up where we left off last time. So that puts us in the early 1800s. As promised, we are going to talk about dental chairs and amalgams to kick this one off. And we'll also talk a bit about some of the support careers in dental medicine and a little bit about orthodontics, although we're not going to get into a ton of specifics there because that's a huge field. Not going to talk about how braces work, so rest easy. As with the first part, there is only a little bit of squirmy stuff here and nothing is terribly graphic.
Prior to 1832, there were no reclining dental chairs. In Pierre Fauchard's time, he had transitioned patients from the customary sitting on the floor for dental work into sitting in chairs. He recommended comfortable chairs with a back that was the right height to support a patient's tilted back head, as well as armrests, so they had something to grip. A surgeon dentist practicing in Boston in the 1790s named Josiah Flagg had added an adjustable headrest to a Windsor chair, and that had made what a lot of people call the first dental chair. His chair had a handy arm that held the instruments, but it still required the patient to sit upright with their head tipped back. That wasn't exactly comfortable, even when nobody was doing anything in their mouth. But then in 1832, London dentist James Snell, who was a member of the Royal College of Surgeons, came up with a design that had an adjustable seat and backrest. A pump-type hydraulic chair was introduced 40 years later in 1877 by Basil Manley Wilkerson, and that let the patient be positioned horizontally.
Yeah, if sitting up with your head tilted back doesn't sound uncomfortable, do it for like 5 minutes. and then imagine someone trying to pull a tooth or do something else in there. Samuel Stockton White helped expand the availability of dental chairs with his company, SS White Dental Manufacturing Company, starting in 1850. Even before he began offering chairs, White had become the primary U.S. supplier of porcelain teeth. The first patent for porcelain teeth had been issued in France to Nicolas Dubois de Chaumont in 1790, so this idea of porcelain teeth was not new in the 1840s when White started manufacturing them, but he was the first to launch a successful commercial enterprise dedicated to their production. White continued to expand his business with chairs and dental tools and then began publishing a periodical simply titled Dental Newsletter, which was later renamed Dental Cosmos. S.S. White still exists today as a dental supplier.
In 1833, a product called Royal Mineral Succedaneum appeared in the U.S. as a filling amalgam for cavities. And the story behind it has some inconsistencies and fuzzy spots because it was being peddled by two charlatans called the Croqueurs. You may see the Croqueurs referred to as two French brothers, or as an uncle and a nephew, or sometimes as English instead of French. There are even theories there may have been more than two people using this name as a duo. It seems like the Croqueurs, whoever they were, and however many of them there were, possessed a rudimentary grasp of dentistry. They probably got that in France. And then they appear in England at the end of the 18th century working as itinerant surgeon dentists. They slowly expanded their personal story to claim that they had been the surgeon dentist to several royal families. They said their specialty was filling teeth with their own special amalgam.
But that amalgam was toxic. It was made with a large proportion of mercury and filings from silver coins. Aside from being, one, completely gross, and two, poisonous, this filling amalgam also expanded over time. So patients who had it often found that their teeth would later break or crack because of that expansion. And then to make matters worse, the Croqueurs didn't usually bother to clean out teeth before applying this amalgam. So even if their patients did not get cracked teeth, they would often end up with just horrible infections. Before the consequences of this awful dentistry could catch up with them in England, they moved to the U.S. to administer Royal Mineral Succedaneum to the masses here.
In New York, they advertised their services as being performed in comfort and ease for the patient. They assured their gentleness as surgeon dentists, and this attracted a lot of business. Legitimate dentists were horrified and outraged, but the Croqueurs were making a lot of money until patients started getting sick anyway. In an effort to raise public awareness, some dentists started placing notices in papers telling patients what symptoms to watch for that might indicate that they had mercury poisoning. The Society of Surgeon Dentists of the City and State of New York required members to sign a promise that they would not use amalgam. The Croqueurs vanished from the U.S. by the end of 1834. Amalgam had been demonized to a degree that most dentists just simply did not trust it.
It's believed that amalgams used for dental fillings may date back as far as the 7th century in China due to a reference in a writing of a silver paste that was referring to a tooth filling. But we don't know for certain what that may have consisted of. And most fillings that we do know of prior to the 1830s would have been made with silver or gold or tin. But the work of the Croqueurs made people deeply suspicious of amalgams.
In 1839, the American Society of Dental Surgeons was formed, and that was the same year the first dental journal began publication. That was the American Journal of Dental Science. And amalgam was a big topic. Within 7 years, the American Society of Dental Surgeons had decided that the use of amalgams was considered malpractice. They passed a resolution to require members to sign a pledge never to use it. But this actually led to several members resigning and then a lot of conflict within the organization. The requirement was no longer in place just 4 years later. Though some dentists continued to eschew amalgam use, others experimented with better quality materials, although it wasn't until 1895 that an amalgam recognized as workable and safe for patients emerged. That was thanks to the work of Green Vardaman Black.
He's going to pop up again here in a bit, so keep his name in mind. Today, amalgam is still used. It does actually still contain mercury, although that mercury is chemically bonded with the other materials in the mix to significantly decrease risk to patients. It's also certainly a higher grade than what the Croqueurs were using. Other filling options, though, are offered by dentists for patients who might be uncomfortable with the idea of amalgam or particularly mercury, including gold fillings, porcelain filling, and even a composite filling made with resin and powdered glass that can be color matched to the existing tooth.
As dentistry grew as a profession in the early 1800s and things like the amalgam debate popped up, it was becoming apparent that there needed to be some structure around both education and regulation of the field. The first dental school was founded in 1840 by Dr. Horace H. Hayden and Dr. Chapin A. Harris with a charter from the General Assembly of Maryland. The Baltimore College of Dental Surgery offered a Doctor of Dental Surgery, or DDS, degree, and soon dental schools opened in other cities. They built on the model of education that had been established in Baltimore. That institution was consolidated with the University of Maryland in 1923, and it continues as the University of Maryland School of Dentistry.
On the regulation side of things, the first U.S. state to address the issue was Alabama. In 1841, the state enacted the law regulating the practice of dental surgery in Alabama, which stated that, one, the medical boards of the state had to, quote, examine and license applicants to practice dental surgery. Two, people practicing dentistry without a license would have to pay a fine of up to $50 for each instance that they did so. Three, that any bonds or obligations made to practitioners who were not licensed were void. Four, that practicing dentists needed to have their license recorded in the county where they practiced. And five, all existing laws that contradicted this act were repealed by it. This all sounded pretty great, but it was not enforced, and only a few dental licenses were ever granted under this initial act in Alabama.
Another topic that's come up a number of times on the show is anesthesia. William T.G. Morton is generally credited with the first successful use of anesthesia on a patient named Glenn Abbott for a surgery to remove a tumor from his neck in 1846. Previous attempts had not been successful, although a doctor named Crawford Long claimed that he had been successful before Morton. He had not published about his efforts in the field, though.
Yeah, you might recognize the name Crawford Long if you live in Atlanta.
Yeah, I was like, is that the Crawford Long from Emory Crawford Long?
It is the very same. There used to be a hospital named after him. Now it has a different name, but there's still signage that includes his name as part of a memorial. Coming up, we're going to talk about some of North America's early professional organizations for dentists. But first, we will pause for a sponsor break.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. Now, this is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200 percenters. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. If you ever felt like you were always too much this while also never being enough that, this is the podcast for you. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more via my own personal stories, along with interviews with inspiring thought leaders from our community. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community that you need to know. So much of what makes our community so beautiful is our diversity, yet too often, those of us who don't fit into this dumb, stereotypical box of whatever it means to be Latino are left without a voice or just forgotten about. On this show, I celebrate the uniqueness of our culture and invite you to walk in your authenticity. Listen to Life as a Gringo as a part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The American Dental Association formed in 1859. The gathering where it was founded, which took place in Niagara Falls, New York, was catalyzed by ongoing concern about the need for regulation. Even though there were several dental schools producing new, well-trained dentists at that point, there was a greater demand than could be met by their graduates. So there was still this huge street dentist industry operating without training, oversight, or standards. Additionally, that whole drama and debate regarding amalgam had to some degree arrested the development of beneficial materials, and a regulated system could prevent another such event. There was also a concern about the use of advertising to lure patients and whether it was ethical to do so. 26 dentists gathered in Niagara Falls to form this initial group and address these issues.
Just 10 years later, in 1869, a splinter group formed called the Southern Dental Association, comprising dentists who had resigned from the ADA after the Civil War. The two groups remained separate for almost 30 years, and they finally combined again in 1897. They had a brief name change to the National Dental Association before reverting back to that original name.
In another move to regulate, the National Association of Dental Examiners was founded in 1883 by sitting members of the dental boards from several states as a move to develop uniform standards of qualifications throughout the country. This group was formed not just to oversee dentists as a profession, but also to oversee state dental boards and legislation related to dentistry.
The first woman to graduate from dental school in the U.S. was Lucy Beeman Hobbs, later Lucy Beeman Hobbs Taylor. She was part of the 1866 graduating class of the Ohio College of Dental Surgery. She's on the list for a future episode, so we won't go into her whole story here. But she had, unsurprisingly, a hard time getting accepted into dental school. That was after she had already been denied entrance to medical school. She had to really circumvent the system and learned on her own, practicing dental medicine out of her own established office for long enough that by the time she was admitted to Ohio College of Dental Surgery, it was pretty much a formality. She went to one session and then was given her degree.
The Harvard University Dental School was the first dental school affiliated with a university. It opened in 1867 and had another milestone just 2 years later when the first Black man in the United States was given a dental degree. That man was Dr. Robert Tanner Freeman. He was the son of formerly enslaved parents. Freeman had applied to two other dental schools, and he had been denied based entirely on his race. He had been working as an assistant to a dentist for a while before that, so he was well qualified. After graduating, though, from Harvard, he practiced in Washington, D.C. for the next 4 years, but unfortunately he died suddenly from an illness that was waterborne at the age of just 26.
We mentioned dentifrice earlier when talking about John Baker, and this was a product. It was a powder that could scrub your teeth clean. And just as the practice of dentistry wasn't initially regulated, it took a long time for tooth cleaners to be regulated, and often they were really dangerous. Some powdered dentifrices were made with things like ground coral, which would clean your teeth. They would also strip them of their enamel. Those early offerings weren't mass-produced, though. Large-scale toothpaste production didn't start until the 1880s. This is when the move was made to package it in tubes, although initially the quality remained pretty hit or miss. By the early 20th century, toothpaste had become a standard part of oral hygiene, although there were still some powders being made.
Toothbrushes similarly had sort of a late bloom, even though they had been around for hundreds and in some cases thousands of years in some form or another. It is believed that the first toothbrush to really resemble those that you would commonly see today was made in China in the late 15th century, that being like the bristles that are perpendicular to the handle. There were others that were developing in various places that looked almost more like a paintbrush, where the bristles were an extension of the handle. And in the 17th and 18th century, similar toothbrushes to that one in China existed in Europe, but these were tended to be kind of fancy. They would often have ivory handles, and they were used primarily just by the upper class. For a long time, cloths or even sponges were used as the primary teeth cleaning instruments for the average person. And it wasn't until the 1850s that toothbrushes were manufactured in significant quantity. The first patent for a toothbrush in the United States was issued in 1857. That went to none other than SS White Manufacturing. Nylon bristles were introduced in 1938 by DuPont. Up to that point, natural bristles like boar's hair were used. And the first electric toothbrush came out in 1960.
As I was looking for pictures to put on our social media, I saw all of these old toothbrush pictures, and so many of them had bristles that looked more like the texture I would expect from, like, a hairbrush or a shaving brush, and not a toothbrush.
Seems like it would be very pokey on your gums.
Yeah. Or just too soft, like the other direction, too, in some of them. It really, yeah. Dentist Charles Edmund Kells of New Orleans was the first doctor known to hire women assistants to help in his practice, and that started in 1885. His first assistant was his wife, and his next hire for the job was a young woman named Malvina Quiria. This was kind of a catch-all job, part receptionist, part dental assistant. It became trendy for dental offices to have women on staff in these kinds of roles, leading to signs that read "lady in attendance" being commonplace at dentist offices. Having a woman on staff made it acceptable for women patients to come in for appointments without their husbands or another male relative to accompany them.
Yeah, initially it seems sort of quaint and you're like, what are you doing? But it really made dentistry more available to a lot of people. For example, a single woman would have had a hard time if she didn't have a male relative, like if she was truly on her own, going to a dentist's office would have seemed kind of scandalous if there was not another lady present there. So it really did kind of shift accessibility in an important way. And this was, we should note, this dental assistant role, very different than a hygienist, although the two positions were in some ways coalescing at roughly the same time. They have some overlap. Even though that started in the 1880s, in 1913, the first school for hygienists, the Fonez Clinic for Dental Hygienists, opened in Bridgeport, Connecticut. That school was run by Alfred Sifonis, who had trained his cousin, Irene Newman, as a dental assistant, and then he started adding duties like cleaning and preventative care to her work. This began because Irene did really, really well with children at the practice initially, and so he thought that maybe she could work on those kinds of things with kids. The graduates of Fonis' program were actually hired by the Board of Education in Bridgeport to perform teeth cleaning clinics in schools. And because of this work, Dr. Fonis is known as the father of dental hygiene. In 1917, his cousin, Irene Newman, became known as the first person to have a dental hygiene license.
Even though dental assistants were around for decades before hygienists, it wasn't until 1924 that the American Dental Assistants Association was founded. This group was created by Juliet A. Sothard and other dental assistants in New York. They had heard of other smaller dental assistant groups in places like Nebraska. In 1929, the ADAA established a scholarship for dental assistants that continues today. It is called the Juliet A. Sothard Scholarship.
Yeah, I was impressed in doing this research that that scholarship was set up within just a few years of them establishing as a group. Although the first dental laboratory had opened in New York City in the 1850s, it wasn't until 1887 that a commercial dental lab opened that became the Stowe and Eddy Dental Laboratory. Prior to this, most dentists performed their own lab work, but once an industrial option was available, most practices started to hand off that kind of work that they were doing, like creating crowns and bridges, to labs, because the whole thing was a lot more efficient that way.
In 1890, Ida Gray graduated from the University of Michigan School of Dentistry, and this made her the first Black woman in the U.S. to receive a dental degree. Her story in dental medicine started when she was a teenager living with her aunt, and she got a job working as an assistant to a dentist named Jonathan Taft. Taft was tasked by the University of Michigan with setting up their dental college just as Ida was graduating from high school. Taft advocated on her behalf for admittance and prepared her for the entrance exam. Once she had her degree, Ida opened up a practice in Cincinnati, Ohio, and she ran a very successful business. According to a book written about prominent Black women of the area in 1893, her clientele were evenly split among Black and white patients. She practiced for almost 30 years before retiring in 1928. She lived into her 80s, dying in 1953.
Coming up, we're going to talk about some realizations about the causes and effects of some dental conditions, as well as the birth of orthodontics as a field. And we'll get into all of that after we pause for a sponsor break.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Abusers in Hollywood are as old as the Hollywood sign itself. And while fame is the ultimate prize in Tinseltown, underneath it lies a shroud of mystery. Binge this season of Variety Confidential from Variety, Hollywood's number one entertainment news source, and iHeart Podcasts. 6 episodes are waiting for you right now to dive into what lies beneath the glitzy image of Hollywood's golden age and all the sex, money, and murder that's been swept under the rug for decades. Using the Variety archives, each episode offers a rare glimpse into little-known casting couch stories that have long lived in the shadows. So join us as we navigate the tangled web of Hollywood's secret history with host Tracy Patton, along with expert Variety reporters and correspondents, as they discuss the secret history of the casting couch to explore the scandalous history of Hollywood's casting process. Listen to Variety Confidential on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The same year that Ida Gray received her dental degree, 1890, an article titled Microorganisms of the Human Mouth was published by Willoughby D. Miller. Miller lived and worked in Berlin, and he was a professor at the University of Berlin, but he was a U.S. citizen born in Ohio. Miller is credited with making the connection that bacteria led to tooth decay in a process that he described and which came to be known as the chemico-parasitic theory. Basically, when eating food causes sugar levels to rise in your mouth, bacteria gets right on in there to gnaw on that, and they produce acid, and that breaks down the tooth and thus cavities. This idea that your mouth was full of microorganisms that were causing tooth decay really catalyzed the messaging that we still hear today, that healthy teeth and gums require regular brushing and flossing.
While orthodontia, so the correction of irregularities in the teeth, had been practiced since the middle of the 19th century, it really wasn't recognized as a specialty for quite some time. In 1900, Dr. Edward Hartley Engel established the Engel School of Orthodontia in St. Louis, Missouri. This was just kind of formalizing lectures and training he'd been giving to other dentists for years by that point. He had been practicing orthodontia exclusively since 1892. The school's creation firmly established the field and earned Engel the nickname the Father of Orthodontics. It's a relatively short educational cycle of just a few weeks because the students were already licensed dentists who wanted training in this specific discipline. The American Society of Orthodontia, formed by one of his early graduating classes, was established in 1901. And by 1907, the idea of focusing on orthodontics as a specialty became established enough that there was a journal, American Orthodontist. The American Board of Orthodontics was established in 1930.
On February 13, 1906, U.S. patent number 812554 was issued to German chemist Alfred Einhorn for his invention, alkanine esters of para-aminobenzoic acid. In search for an anesthetic that could replace the addictive and dangerous option of cocaine that was being used by the medical profession at the time, he had created a substance called procaine, which was later known by the more common name you probably recognize, Novocaine, meaning a new cane. Although Novocaine offered a less powerful anesthetic option, it was also so much safer than cocaine that dentists really embraced it. It was not, to be clear, the first synthetic anesthetic. Amilocaine was created 2 years earlier by Ernest Fourneau. And Novocaine wasn't created for dentistry. It was intended for general surgeries. But because it was a local numbing agent and not something that would make a patient unconscious, which most surgeons really, really wanted to be the case, surgeons did not really want to use it. But it was perfect for dentistry.
I am 46 years old and just noticed the suffix cane on all of these analgesic products. In 1908, a two-volume book called Operative Dentistry was published by Green, Vardam, and Black. Mr. Black was really quite an interesting character in a variety of ways, but he's most known for his contributions to dentistry. Well before the book we just mentioned came out, he had been an innovator in the field. He had invented motors for use with dental drills. He had patented improvements to the drills themselves. He had written about microorganisms and the ways they produce substances that can be poisonous to humans. He'd written books on dental anatomy and had created standards and practices for the treatment and filling of cavities that were adopted by dentists throughout the U.S. and Europe, just to name a few. Operative dentistry continued to standardize the field by establishing clear protocols for various procedures.
Yeah, and if you recall earlier in this episode, we mentioned that he really formed the first stable, consistent amalgam that people were willing to use and recognized as safe. And because of all of these achievements, of course, lots of people wanted to meet with him. And he was invited specifically to speak to the Colorado State Dental Association in 1909. And that invitation had been catalyzed by a dentist named Frederick McKay, who had a practice in Colorado Springs. And this was really because McKay wanted to ask the esteemed expert about a phenomenon that he had noticed in a lot of his patients: rather intense brown stains on their teeth. This was so common in the area that it had the nickname of Colorado Brown Stain. And when Black arrived in Colorado Springs, he too immediately noticed that even young children there had these stained teeth. The people with stained teeth, though, had what seemed like a natural resistance to tooth decay. To be clear, these were not any sort of early cavities or indicators of disease. It was literally just discoloration. So Black, who was intrigued, kind of worked on this puzzle until he died in 1915. But even after he died, McKay continued, and eventually it was discovered that waterborne fluoride was leading to the staining. That staining is known today as fluorosis.
And that discovery, connected with the recognition that some fluoride exposure led to resistance to cavities, that led to the development of fluoridated drinking water with a level of fluoride that would confer health benefits to the tooth enamel without the negative cosmetic side effects of the staining. This work on developing fluoridation plans took decades, but in 1944, Grand Rapids, Michigan became the first city on Earth to have fluoridated drinking water. In 11 years of collecting data on the oral health of the children of Grand Rapids, it was determined that the rate of tooth decay in those children had dropped by 60%. Today, more than 200 million people in the U.S. benefit from fluoridation projects, and fluoride is touted as an ingredient in toothpastes and mouthwashes.
All because of some stained teeth. In 1948, the National Institute of Dental Research was established by congressional bill, which was signed by President Harry S. Truman. This established an institution that could study issues of oral health in the U.S. with money from the federal government to back that research. One of the things that had motivated this was actually World War II, because a significant number of otherwise seemingly healthy men had been rejected for military service because they had missing teeth or significant dental disease. And this had indicated that this was a significant potential health issue for the country.
The man selected to lead the NIDR was Henry Trendley Dean. He had been in charge of the dental division at the National Institute of Health beginning in 1931, and it was Dean who Frederick McKay had appealed to in that role to look at the fluoridation question more closely, which is what had led to the testing program in Grand Rapids.
In 1950, 2 years into his tenure at the NIDR, Dean was featured in an article in Tick Magazine. That was a trade periodical published by the Taconium Company. The article opened with, quote, "The shape of things to come in dentistry is now being projected in research units, which are being augmented all over America. For the first time in history, a coordinated nationwide attack on dental disease is underway." This write-up gives some statistics about this program and mentions that $212,000 annually were being spent on research studies at the NIDR, and that there were, quote, 36 separate projects underway at the time of the article's writing. Dean is quoted in the article as saying, quote, "We are making it possible for the total resources of dentistry to be applied to the tremendous problems of dental disease on a scale never before possible. This is, in a very real sense, dentistry's own program, with dentists participating in policymaking and in program planning, with dentists supervising and directing research projects, and with dentists doing actual research themselves."
NIDR's name changed in 1998 to the National Institute of Dental and Craniofacial Research. In the 74 years since the Institute was established, there have been projects headed by the dental researchers that touch on a lot of issues, including cancer, arthritis, and cystic fibrosis, as well as many others.
Yeah, they have done a number of studies, for example, of HIV and AIDS, and bigger global issues of how, like, public health is impacting the populations of the world. They do a lot of cool projects there. The dental field continues, of course, to evolve. Advancements like improved resins and products like at-home tooth whitening, and even the use of lasers to treat tooth decay and gum disease, are actually all pretty relatively recent developments in the field.
There are an estimated 1.6 million dentists practicing globally, but even so, a lot of people are not getting adequate dental care. A U.S. News and World Report article from July 2021 reported that even before the pandemic, an estimated one-third of adults in the U.S. weren't getting regular dental care. Some of this is a money issue. The whole thing where dental insurance is a separate thing from health insurance, and that even with the insurance, it's still really expensive to have anything other than just, like, regular cleanings. It's a big issue. Some of it is an availability issue. For example, in rural areas, dentists are often a lot farther away from most people, or practices that exist don't have enough hygienists or dental assistants to serve their communities. People are also just scared of the dentist.
Yes. And on a global scale, according to the World Health Organization's report, Global Burden of Disease Study 2019, oral disease, often preventable, because we're talking about things like tooth decay and gum disease being the most prevalent in their statistics, those diseases affect nearly 3.5 billion people worldwide. And one of the biggest problems, according to that report, is, quote, "unequal distribution of oral health professionals and a lack of appropriate health facilities to meet population needs." So we've come a long way, but we still have some big problems to solve.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are so many health issues that can be connected back to untreated dental problems.
Yes,
I kind of
hate
it. The whole division between dentistry and medicine is, like, that's a whole other topic, but it's one of those things that I find really frustrating just in my own everyday life.
Yeah, I, like I said, I was terrified of the dentist for a long time and then found the right dental practice for me, which I will talk about in our behind the scenes. And
yeah,
it has made all the difference on earth. I also have some fun listener mail. This made me laugh so hard. It may just be me, but it hits all of my key delight points. So this is from our listener, Betsy, who writes, "Hi, Holly and Tracy. The microwave episode brought back memories of my family's first microwave, which we got probably in the early 70s. My mother wanted one, but it was expensive. So while my father was on a week-long fishing trip, she was a bit annoyed about that, she bought the microwave. We tried all sorts of cooking experiments that week. The most memorable one was a cake. It came out very odd-looking on the surface, bumps, divots, ridges, and holes. My brother and I decorated the cake with paper flags on toothpicks labeled with names of features of the moon, because the cake definitely looked like the surface of the moon. Thanks for sparking a walk down memory lane with my mother about our first microwave. She does not remember the moon cake. Betsy." Betsy, I love the idea that two kids came up with this idea of labeling a cake with all of the features of the moon. This is like a magical bit of imaginative interaction with food, and I'm all behind it. Now I want to make a moon cake.
Mm-hmm.
I love the moon. As you may or may not recall, I have a tattoo of the first map of the moon.
Oh, yeah.
On my leg. So the idea of making a cake that looks like it, even more hilarious and wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing this with me. Now I want to make some microwave cake and just probably won't label it. I'll just eat it. But if you would like to write to us about your successful or not microwave cakes or anything, you know, we've said many times, animals, foods, anything in our episodes, whatever delights you. Still loving those recipes. Keep them coming. You can do so at historypodcast@iheartradio.com. You can also find us on social media as Missed in History. And you can subscribe to the show on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
Ladies and gentlemen,
we are coming back to Atlanta
right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Oh, hi. I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.